You're listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety, where you'll hear conversations and insights from public safety professionals and those who train and support them. To learn more about CMPS training programs, visit mindfulpublicsafety.org.
Hi, welcome to another session on day six of the Global First Responder Resilience Summit. Today, our focus is leading healthy change in public safety. And I'm here with Dr. Suzanne Nabi-Nicole. So welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you very much. That was a pretty good pronunciation.
I did my best.
And it often goes very wrong.
Nabi, is it a German name?
You would think Knabe is German. It is actually a German word. It's old-fashioned for boy or lad. But I think it's actually Swedish. I think there was a Swedish person called Knabe who went over to Poland, had some generations of people, and then my parents moved to Germany. So it's a bit of a trick, I think. It sounds German, is German, but actually comes from Sweden somehow.
So you pronounce the K, Knabe then? Knabe?
Knabe.
Knabe, yeah. Okay. So Dr. Knabe Nicole. So I'm going to share a bit of your bios to familiarize our audience with your work, and then we'll just jump right into the conversation, okay?
Yeah, sure.
Great. So Dr. Knabe Nicole worked in United Kingdom, UK policing for over a decade and completed a PhD in investigative psychology part-time. She set up Police Science Doctor to create a broad range of research-based videos. And the plan is for a global communication platform for researchers and practitioners, as well as a collection of police-relevant courses, all in one place. Suzanne has the desire to make research accessible and skilled herself up to be able to create online courses and interactive videos. So now she wants to help the policing community with these assets. There's an awful lot of great research being done and published, but then only read by other academics. This just doesn't make sense. So she started turning research into videos, as every officer can make time to watch a short video, but they might not be able to access and digest a research paper. Let's start with your background in policing. So you had a varied career being involved with both investigations and then culture change and improvements in policing with both the Suffolk and Norfolk Constabularies, if I'm pronouncing it right, in the United Kingdom. So could you talk a bit about that background?
So there was a number of different roles and actually a number of forces as well. So I started out as a uniformed police community support officer, similar uniform to police officers. This role is sort of always defined as the eyes and ears of the police and community policing. You have your patch, you build relationships with the residents, with the community, with shopkeepers, and you have many of the powers of a police officer, many of the jobs, but you don't have power to arrest, which I didn't mind at the time. I wasn't keen to start wrestling with people and rolling around on the floor. That was not for me. So that was my first experience of policing. I did that in London briefly only because I signed up to do that job before, after applying to do the master's in investigative psychology. But I had just missed the deadline. So I thought I'll do that for a year and get some policing experience, which I thought would be really useful. It actually took a lot longer to get in than I thought with the whole recruitment process, assessment centers and vetting. So it took 5 months. So I only had the summer, really, spring and summer, to actually do that role. I then did my master's full time, and then after that went back into working and did a variety of roles like regional intelligence analyst, major crime researcher, investigator. That was quite interesting because I was working in the custody investigation unit, preparing interviews, carrying out interviews with suspects, preparing files for court. And then I started working in what we would call evidence-based policing, you know, which you described as culture change and improvements. That after that, I then left the police and worked for the Cambridge Center of Evidence-Based Policing as director of communications. After I had finished my PhD, which I'd been doing part-time this whole time, I think it took about 8 years, I also set up a website, which is Police Science Doctor, as you mentioned, because I thought there was so much fantastic information out there about policing and criminology, investigative psychology, and everything that could help the police practitioner and law enforcement, but it wasn't being communicated to the law enforcement practitioner. It was mainly being consumed by other people who were doing similar research. And I think it was really, I wanted to create this channel of, you know, research finding relevant. Here you go. You're the one who's going to use it here. And I package that in a video, in as a podcast, you know, as little visual snippets. And I do a live stream every Tuesday. Everybody who's on my email list gets an email with three police science snippets every Tuesday. So these are golden nuggets of information that are actionable that I think they should know about and they might want to know about. And so that's what I do with Police Science Doctor. And this is where we are.
Well, it's really important. And I've watched a number of the videos, and I think this is so important to get this research in the hands of the people that can really implement it and use it, because otherwise it's just a conversation, as you said, among academics, and it's not going to really have the impact that it needs to have. So you kind of answered my second question, what inspired you to start Police Science Doctor? But then perhaps you could talk more about what is evidence-based policing? What do we mean by that?
So evidence-based practice in general is simply doing something that has been tried and tested. Fortunately, we have become accustomed to expect medicine and medical procedures to have been tried and tested before they're being performed on us. So you wouldn't really take medication if it hadn't been approved, tested in some kind of circumstances. They often start with mice, and then they hope that somehow it relates to how humans would respond. Then they have human trials. And This has become quite common in medicine, and we expect that. But when it comes to policing and some other practices, education, for example, our education system is not evidence-based. We've been teaching in schools and in universities the same way we've been doing it for hundreds of years. Somebody stands at the front and speaks at people. They're supposed to absorb it, understand it, process it, and supposed to be able to use it. That doesn't really work, but we're doing it the same way it's always been done. So evidence-based practice is the opposite of doing things the way that they have always been done. It's questioning, hang on, so how are we doing this? Is there a better way of doing it? Let's compare the two. Let's test. So we set up a little pilot, a little study, a little research project, and then we try and find, okay, which one of those two practices works better? And then we should carry on with the one that does work better. We should replicate it. We should fine-tune it. And we should then roll it out further. So evidence-based practice means make sure that what you're doing has been shown to work. If it hasn't been shown to work, test it. And if it doesn't work better than something you're comparing it to, adjust it or drop it. And in policing, really, the policing has changed so much because the demands of the communities, the demands of crime have changed so much. We haven't really caught up yet. And as we were talking about earlier, new findings are not being communicated down to practitioners. People have, new police officers have a certain number of weeks of initial training. Then they might have some refresher training. They might have some specialist trainings when they become police detectives, for example. But other than that, there is no regular way of refreshing their knowledge and their skills. Like I think there is the case with medicine. I think doctors have some kind of system set up for them where they refresh their knowledge on what the new research findings are, what the new guidelines are, and guidelines being updated all the time. In policing, it's much more slow. And I think it could be improved a lot and in terms of becoming more evidence-based. And there are a lot of initiatives. There are societies of evidence-based policing in the UK. That was the first one. And I'm working with them on their communications and on their conferences. There's one in New Zealand and Australia. There's one in Canada, one in America. And there are other organizations and companies that are trying to embed evidence-based practice more in policing. And some of that is coming from the private sector. And I find that very interesting, but evidence-based practice also means investigative psychology. For example, it has been tried and tested how best to interview suspects, witnesses, how not to interview, how to investigate, how you can make your investigations more efficient. And all of that is evidence-based practice because it has been tested by researchers who are studying the field. And then we just need to make sure, and again, that's something that I try to do, we bring that knowledge to the practitioner. So there's a lot of information that I share for free, but I also work together with subject matter experts, some of whom have conducted that research, to create training based on their findings. And the Police Science Doctor Academy is a growing resource for that, for training courses to bring that evidence-based practice to the practitioner.
Well, that is such important work. I would imagine one place where probably the science has been more present in policing has probably been in forensics and some of the technology there and the science of forensics, but operationally. And I'm wondering if evidence-based policing gets down to the level of how to do community policing, or very especially with everything that's been going on in the last couple of years, well, for a long time, and it's finally we're dealing with it socially and politically with the use of force, use of deadly force and so forth. So is there much research and evidence being done around, you know, how to develop policy and operational procedures based on science and evidence?
There is. And there's, you talked earlier about culture change, and we do require a culture change because the authoritative way of policing is damaging and harmful. It's damaging to community relations. It's damaging to the officers who are being put more at risk because they're being met with hostility from the communities, and it's damaging for the communities. There are better ways of policing that are depending much more on what's called softer skills. And they haven't quite got the respect yet in the very masculine, testosterone-driven world of policing, because they are things like listening skills, empathy, and emotional intelligence, and simply communication. You need to be a good communicator, but we are still recruiting the testosterone-driven people into policing. When you look at many recruitment videos for police forces or police agencies, departments, there's fast music, there's cars with sirens, red light, blue lights, and, you know, slapping handcuffs on someone, rolling around on the floor, seizing drugs, when actually only about 20% of calls that come into police are about crime. The vast majority is about other issues, many of them mental health issues. So really, we should be looking for people who have social work skills, who have educational skills, who can really speak to people, who have maybe a background in therapy. And also, it's there are some factors that are correlated to less use of force in policing. For example, police officers who have a university degree, when they get in, they tend to use less force, and also more diverse officers, women and people from other ethnic groups. If you have a more mixed force, you have fewer incidents of violence, which is safer for the community and safer for policing. So we're still recruiting masculine, macho type of people. And that is wrong, because that doesn't match with the demands of the job. And it doesn't match with how people want to be treated and need to be treated and need to be dealt with, because many of them are in a state of emotional crisis when they're interacting with the police. You know, the police are cynical, and I totally understand why. They're interacting one person after the other, after the other, after the other, is in kind of crisis, you know, screaming, shouting, scared. You know, they're not having, especially response officers who are going to the calls, are not having, you know, wonderful, nice conversations over tea with the members of the public, are they? They're making life decisions, life and death decisions on the spot. They're there to protect people from others and from themselves. And that is a very, very difficult job. I can't think of many other jobs in the world where what you're supposed to be doing is by definition always going to go against someone's will. Maybe parking attendants. And, you know, they're not very popular either. But unfortunately, you don't interact with them too much. You see a ticket on your car, you know, you might swear and you take it. And
I've been upset with a few parking attendants.
Exactly. And the police, you know, they come when there's a problem. So you don't have positive interactions with them. You don't have many opportunities to have very positive interactions with them. So the whole way that policing is done at the moment is set up for negative experiences, unfortunately. And I've given a lot of information now. I don't
know. No, it's really good. And, you know, we really haven't prepared our police officers to interact with the public in skillful ways. And with, not to say that there aren't officers who do, there certainly are officers out there with a lot of community policing skills. But in general, we haven't trained, prepared, and recruited people with that in mind, and haven't given them the skills to keep themselves safe other than just, you know, brute force, right? Or numbers. And so, yeah, there's a lot of things. A lot of my background work is in the corrections field, and it's really the same thing there. I mean, we're modern corrections. It's hard to even call it modern corrections. It's just barely moving into evidence-based work. And And, you know, it's just as damaging to the officers the way the work is done. And that's why we have such high rates of suicidality among police officers and correctional officers and other first responders. And so working in that way is damaging to them, damaging to everyone involved. And yeah, so it's much needed change, and it is culture change. And I think it does have a lot to do with recruitment. I was part of a National Institute of Corrections think tank project a number of years back. And one of the projects that we zeroed in on was really workforce change. And we decided really what needed to change was really the curriculum and the criminal justice programs and the recruitment practices of law enforcement and correctional agencies. And really, like you were saying, we need people with more of a social work background, more training in psychology, and then also all the necessary training in security and police operations or correctional operations and so forth. But instead, we're tending to draw upon military veterans or people that are kind of attracted to the testosterone, you know, driven approach, which not necessarily masculine. There is healthy masculine, but you're referencing that kind of very macho old school masculine, which absolutely. And it is really, I think, a long overdue process of cultural change. And it's going to be good for everybody. I mean, it's certainly going to be difficult for, you know, some folks in law enforcement who are kind of old school and used to that way. But in the end, it's really going to be healthier for everybody. And I think from the work I'm doing out in the world, I'm seeing among young recruits coming into the academies much more interest in a healthier approach to their careers. Even though some of them are still coming in for kind of the wrong reasons, right, because of the recruitment practices. So you've had a lot of experience in the investigative side of police work. And I'm wondering if are there ways that even investigative work has been done? There's the police who are out there in the community who end up doing the arrest, that go on the calls and you know, confront a lot of uncertainty and danger. You pull someone over here in the U.S. because there's so many guns in the community. I mean, a police officer who's pulling someone over for a traffic ticket, even, you know, it has to be very cautious and potentially nervous, and it pulls someone over with more danger signals, right? So, you know, there's a lot of risk there. And for the police officers that are out in the community interacting with the public and making arrests and so forth. But I'm wondering if in the way that investigative policing has been done, if there's also a lot of danger of burnout and PTSD because of ongoing exposure to chronic stress. And I mean, in investigative police, I don't know enough about that to speak directly, but I suppose there's the kind of post, you know, the more analytical and lab-based, but then there's the actual investigators that go out to the crime scenes. They're experiencing a lot of secondary trauma, I would imagine.
Yes, because obviously we're separating here response policing, the officers who actually go to an incident and deal with it there and then the ones who come in after that to investigate all of that. They might not have the urgency of the, you know, I need to intervene straight away to protect this person. But there can be a lot of secondary trauma. So you have to, in order to investigate something properly, you have to understand the crime really well. You have to do the research into what's happened, get the information from all the different kind of sources that you possibly can. You need to be very, very skilled. And that's becoming a lot more apparent now than it used to be in how to speak to people and how to interview. And for that, I find it funny when people don't see the connection between psychology and policing, because policing is literally single-handedly only about interacting with people. And there's nothing else in policing. It's about crime, preventing crime, investigating crime. That's all got to do with people and behavior. And behavior is psychology. So there's psychology in every single aspect of policing. Maybe not in the forensic DNA analysis. That's a different kind of science. But in terms of behavioral science, it's very, very relevant. It's relevant when we interview a witness after an incident, how we interview them, how we make sure that we get that information out of their heads in a way that doesn't actually taint the information because of how we are asking or when we are asking. It's important how we interact with the suspect. So we're moving away from the whole, we have moved away over here definitely from the coercive tactics and authoritative stance in interviews, and it's a much more collaborative approach. The person is a suspect. They may or may not have committed the offense. That's one thing. They may be completely innocent, but you want to get information from them, either information that shows you that they are not involved, information that you didn't have before, whether they were involved or not, or information that shows you they are involved. So you need to get that suspect to work with you and to cooperate with you. And there's ways of doing that. And it's not the authoritative approach. It's not the deceptive, dominant approach at all. So there's so much psychology in the whole interviewing process and in investigations that I'm really interested in that aspect, actually. And I'm creating a number of courses with experts on that for the academy. And in terms of burnout, because you need to do so much research of a case, and you know, especially cases that are, tend to be more upsetting, sexual assaults, child sexual abuse, the officers have to really dig into that information. They have to process it, and they have to then speak to the person that may have committed those offenses, and they need to show that person, you know, due respect. They need to show them empathy and understanding, and they need to be very open-minded. They should not approach them with a mindset of "I'm judging you" or "I think you did it," at all. That's very difficult. I know that from my experience of being an interviewer. It's very difficult not to make up your mind beforehand. It happens sometimes without you noticing it, and there is secondary exposure, definitely. But you then, because you also speak to the victims and you hear their experiences and their story, and then you speak to the person who may have committed that, so that's very upsetting. And then there's obviously the people who are very, very important, and I don't know how they do it, who have to go through all the materials that may contain child sexual abuse material. I never want to see a single image or piece of footage of that at all. But they're going through that, and it needs to be done. And the potential for trauma, I think, is immense for that. However, in some cases, they tend to have fewer traumatic symptoms because their job is valued. It's valued by colleagues, it's valued by superiors, and it's valued by the public. Whereas response officers, as we were talking about earlier, they are always very often dealing with someone who doesn't want them there. So they don't get that appreciation very often. They're vilified in the media. If one officer somewhere in the world does something wrong, all of a sudden, the police all over the world may be stoned. You know, it's a very, very strange phenomenon. So there is so much potential for trauma in investigations as well. And it's difficult to make the right decision of, you know, if somebody is a very good investigator who deals with sexual abuse, child abuse, should they stay in that role or should they move on because they need some respite from it? It's a difficult decision to make because you need to look after the mental health of that person. You need to look after the mental health of every police officer, every member of staff, and we're not doing that at all enough. You were talking earlier about they're being taught how to look after themselves, but that's only physically. They're not being taught how to look after themselves mentally and emotionally at all.
I'd like to follow up on a couple of points there. I mean, one, I think that the general citizenry, it doesn't realize the world that our police officers live in, whether they're on the response side or the investigation side. You know, just seeing things and having to deal with things and talk about things and hear about things that most of us just never have to deal with. And I think we don't have enough appreciation for the challenges of what they deal with. And I want to get to the impact of trauma and what police need to take care of themselves. But before that, back to the your emphasis that it really is a lot about behavioral psychology and policing is people work, right? It's all about interactions between human beings. I'm curious. I know that some police officers and some senior officers, maybe even some investigators, do go on to get advanced degrees in psychology. But is there actually any required training? A police officer moves into investigations, becomes a detective, you know, in the length of their career, would they necessarily receive any training in psychology unless they voluntarily choose to go pursue an advanced degree on their own?
I don't think they get any specific training on psychology. Here in the UK, if you become a detective, you get advanced training on witness interviewing and suspect interviewing, which might take two or three weeks. But then again, that's it. You get some. It is mainly the guidance of it. It's not that much psychology, and there's so much more that could be taught. And I've recently released a course with a very renowned psychologist and scientist called Professor Ray Bull. He is one of the big giants when it comes to investigative interviewing of suspects, for example. And it's a short course. It's an introductory course, and you know, everybody's welcome to take it. It's called How Best to Interview Suspects. And I think it's going to be the officers and the investigators who take the initiative to improve their skills further rather than just rely on what the department is giving them in terms of training, who may do better in these kind of roles and these kind of tasks. Because I think the basic training, some people are natural police, you know, they're naturally great with people, they're naturally open-minded and positive, and it comes across in how they deal with people. But others, they have a different mindset, but the training could benefit everyone. So unfortunately, there's not a specific teaching of psychology that is being brought out to everyone. Here in the UK, what's interesting at the moment is that something that's recently started is the degree apprenticeship. So everyone who becomes a police officer in their first year, 3 years of training, whilst they are becoming a fully fledged, independent, qualified police officer, they're also getting a degree. So there's three routes into that, but eventually everybody has a degree if they didn't already have one in policing. And that is to acknowledge the immense amount of learning and skills that you attain whilst you're a police officer, rather than, you know, thinking, well, it's just something that you do, and then you might leave after 10 years and you have no qualifications. Well, actually, you now have a policing degree. And it was being met with skepticism because people thought you had to have a degree before you go into policing. And, you know, why is that necessary? It excludes so many people. And I agree with that. I don't think everyone who could be a fantastic police officer needs to have a degree before they start, but they will now get one whilst they're becoming a police officer, which I think is actually quite good. So there's a lot of universities now involved and having contracts with police agencies to provide some of that training. And that's great potential to infuse police training with more and more behavioral science, I think.
That's brilliant. I think it's a really smart idea. And also, it, you know, getting a college degree brings with it a certain, you know, a certain credibility and self-esteem and so forth. And I think can just bring more dignity to the job, right? And I think all that, I mean, you said there's evidence showing that police officers who have a college degree are less likely to inappropriately use force, right, when it's not necessary. So that seems to be all to the good. So what about, you know, you mentioned self-care, and I know that we have not provided anywhere near enough support and knowledge around good self-care and good critical post-critical incident care. And, you know, we've developed a model called mindfulness-based wellness and resiliency initially for correctional officers primarily, but now we're working with police, probation and parole, lots of public safety officials. But, and fortunately, there is a tremendous amount of science about this, not directly related to policing yet, although there is some research, and we're going to be presenting some of that research here at this summit. But there's a lot of research around trauma and trauma treatment and self-care and the risks of PTSD and the antecedents of PTSD and really how to mitigate the risk of ongoing exposure to chronic stress and both primary and secondary trauma. So there's a lot of research out in the world about that. And what do you see in terms of bringing that research into policing so that we can give police officers the information they need to take good care of themselves off shift, to maybe do their jobs in ways that aren't quite so damaging to themselves, and also to get the kind of support and care they need following some kind of critical incident they might be involved in?
Yeah, the frustrating thing about that is that all the knowledge that we need and all the tools are already in existence. They're just not being applied. So I recently held a webinar on mental health in policing. And, you know, anyone watching this is very welcome to watch the replay. It's just policesciencedoctor.com/MH for mental health. And I had interviewed 12 people from all over the world, practitioners and experts on some of the aspects about mental health and policing. And then what I pulled together was a PDF that you can download on that page as well with what we need to do about it to turn our police force into a healthy one. And there are certain aspects you can do. So one is you start at the top. You make sure that the chief of police or whatever they may be called, they may be commissioner, they may be captain, you know, whatever, whoever is the head of the organization, it does need to start with them to an extent. So they should be going regularly to get a mental health checkup, and then they should come back to their staff and say, I've had a mental health checkup. It was fine. I want all you to do it. And that it needs to be mandatory. The thing is, if the chief does that, and if it's mandatory, that removes the stigma and that removes the option of, oh no, I'm, you know, I need to appear masculine. I need to appear like I'm tough, that I don't need that. Well, if you're being told to do it, you do it. That's one good thing about the police, that things could be done quickly because you can tell people what to do. It's not a very demographic organization. However, things are still much too slow. So the culture change starts with the chief, really, and it needs to trickle down. The chief needs to be a lot more embracing of mental health care of their staff and themselves, and maybe just talk about it openly. Then there are internal and external provisions then that should be offered. So one massive aspect is training. So we train our officers to apply handcuffs, to do some basic self-defense, some, you know, grappling on the floor. And we give them equipment to keep their bodies safe, you know, the boots, the helmet, stab vest, we call it, bulletproof vest, I guess, in America. But we don't give them the training to keep their mind safe. Once you've been in a fight, you know, how do you process that? People don't usually have those kind of experiences in their normal lives if they're not a police officer, I hope. So we're not really teaching them enough about how to cope with the aftermath and how to deal with experiences and everything that comes with the job nearly as much as we should. So that should be in the basic training, and it should be an ongoing refresher. And they should be mandated to have mental health checkups with a professional. Then you need, so you've got chief for the culture, you've got the training provisions in the beginning and throughout for any level. And then you've got, you need to have internal provisions where you offer peer support, and many departments and forces are doing that, where volunteers are being trained in supporting colleagues. So they could be the first point of contact and just offer a listening, you know, just a listening opportunity, a talking opportunity, a chat to any member of the force or their family even, and they can then signpost for further support. And that's confidential, so there's peer support. You also need to have professional internal support, so counselors, psychologists within the police who have an open door for anyone to come in as often as they need about any topic. So they may not be stressed about the job per se, they may have stress at home, and that's very, very impactive, and it can impact how you work, because we are all people, and you know, we don't just switch off from one thing to the next. So we need to have those internal provisions of support, and we need to have external provisions of support, because police are very cynical and they often don't trust that the internal provisions are really confidential, and then they will not affect their standing, their reputation, their career prospects. So we also need to have external provisions. But these need to be provided by psychologists, counselors, coaches who really understand law enforcement. Because one big drawback, if you go into a normal counselor, is they don't understand the job of policing well enough. So you need to have the culture change with the chief, training, internal provisions, external provisions. And then if you implement all of those, then I think you can really turn your police force around. And I did recently interview a police chief who did provide all of that support, and his insurance bill dropped massively to the extent that the insurance company called up and said, what are you doing? You know, what is going on here? This is great. You know, we're paying out so much less. So the tools are there. The knowledge is there. It just needs to be applied. It needs to be taken by the right people and put into practice.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the whole purpose of this summit, really. And I love what you just said. It was so comprehensive. And yet you emphasize leadership. Leadership really is important. And removing that stigma around mental health. Now, unfortunately, in some first responder agencies in the past, if you went to see a counselor, that could really hurt your career. You could be considered unfit for duty and so forth. I think that's changing very broadly across first responder agencies, but there's still the stigma there. My friend and colleague, Lieutenant Rich Gerling, who's a presenter for this summer and one of our co-hosts, you know, he references that, like, if you're going to do this work, you need to do your regular mental health checkups, right? It's just part of the deal. You know you're going to have the exposure, so you got to take care of yourself. And he just references his mental health coach, right? Just like he regularly goes, gets a physical with his physician. He also sees his mental health coach on a regular basis. It just, you know, so I think the importance of removing that stigma, and probably no more effective way than to get the leadership to lead the way on removing that stigma, as you said. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you've been dedicated to making high quality research available to police. And to police officials and police on the streets through your current project. And, you know, I'm wondering if you're beginning to see some uptake on this, if you're beginning to see more interest from both police leaders and rank and file police in evidence-based policing, in the data, in thinking about new ways of doing things that may be different than, you know, what was passed on to them, you know, but, you know, so is there a shift? Do you see an emerging shift?
I think there's definitely a big interest in evidence-based policing. So obviously I've got a number of different topics that I cover in my videos, but the ones surrounding evidence-based policing are always some of the more popular ones. Because that we have now these, as I mentioned earlier, these organizations around the world that are doing a lot of work in that. And the idea of evidence-based policing, you know, first really brought to the fore by Professor Lawrence Sherman, is being spread out on over across the entire globe. So there's a lot of good work that is being done, because they've got the masters in Cambridge, for example, that a lot of aspiring police leaders go to graduate from. They need to carry out a research project that is evidence-based back in their own home force. And then they go back and they get promoted, and they can hopefully make some good changes and implement some good changes. So a lot of police leaders are really catching up with that idea, which is fantastic. And I can see through the feedback that I get every week. I send out my police science snippets. I get feedback from all over the world. I've got people from really some, you know, very obscure countries that I wouldn't have expected emailing me back saying this is really interesting. This is really useful. And there is an interest and there is a thirst, which is why it's so emotionally rewarding to be doing this, work.
Well, it's really important. I really encourage everyone to check out your website, policesciencedoctor.com, is it?
Yeah,
policesciencedoctor.com. Just a rich array of material there already. I know you're adding more interviews all the time. You're starting to create courses and so forth. And it's just really accessible, you know, really accessible conversations in video. And it's a quick way to get valuable information. So I really encourage our audience to check that out. We're just about near the end of our time here. I'm wondering if you had the opportunity, let's say you had the opportunity to come speak at a conference with, 1,000 police leaders in the audience, right? Chiefs and captains and policymakers as well. What would you say? What would your essential message be in terms of what's really needed from our leadership in leading the way to a healthier approach to policing and law enforcement and just community safety altogether?
Yeah, so if I was able to address the police leaders, and I would say it starts with you. The tools are there. I want you to use them. And it actually pays. You will save a lot of money if you invest in the mental and emotional well-being of your staff. You need to be an advocate and a champion of mental health change in your department, in your force. You need to actively show that you're advocating that and that you're using it and that you're wanting it to be implemented. And you need to supply the provisions, and all that information is there. And also the other thing I would like to mention is because, you know, of this particular audience for this particular summit, that there is actually a course as well on the Police Science Doctor Academy. If you go to policesciencedoctor.com and then /G for golf, M for mother one, you will find the emergency stress pit stop course. And I have actually provided a coupon code for, I think, 30% off for people who attend the summit, because I think it's very, very important that you make some kind of start in building up resilience to stress. And this is an online coaching program in its essence by, you know, a police stress expert who's put that together. And it's for people to work through in their own time, but it helps them to cope with things they've already experienced in terms of symptoms and in terms of experiences. But it also builds up resilience for anything that might come in the future. And it's so important. It's like the stab vest or the bulletproof vest that you wear to work. This is providing a bit of an mental and emotional vest. So I would encourage you to have a look at that and see if that might be right for you. So there's /G for golf, M for mother one. And again, police leaders, it starts with you. If you start the change, it will have a much bigger impact than if you wait for someone else to do it. And it will save you a lot of money. You will have fewer days of sick from your staff, you will have fewer insurance claims and you will have much better retention, and you will have fewer incidents of accidents and use of force if you have a relaxed, mentally capable police force. So it starts with you. Don't pass the buck on to someone else.
Well said, well said. We'll make sure that coupon code is available to our summit audience. Thank you so much. That's so important because I think, you know, law enforcement leaders, public safety leaders, at least here in the U.S., certainly know that the profession is really challenged right now. You know, for lots of reasons, recruitment is very difficult. People are leaving the profession. So there's a tremendous amount of mandatory overtime. Most agencies are having trouble keeping their ranks filled. And then you already have a high stress over chronic stress exposed, trauma exposed workforce. And now you're asking them to do mandatory overtime, which exacerbates everything. It's a vicious cycle going in the wrong way, and it needs to turn around so it can, again, become a healthy profession with high esteem that attracts people for the right reasons. And we know how to get there, right? And I think you just described the starting point of how to get there. So thank you so much for this, Dr. Suzanne Nabi-Nicole, and from PoliceScienceDoctor.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. Best of luck.
Thank you for listening to the Mindful Public Safety Podcast, hosted by the Center for Mindfulness and Public Safety. Video of these podcasts are also available. You'll find access information in the description. And learn more about CMPS training programs at mindfulpublicsafety.org. See you next time.